All right. So thanks for joining me today, Corbin. There's been a bunch of things we've been looking forward to talking about. One of them is the use of the pulmonary artery catheter. And you use something that's a little less commonly used, actually a thermodilution catheter to get an idea, I think, of lung water and things like that. So why don't you tell me how to use that, what you've been doing with it?
Called a transpulmonary thermodilution catheter, and it's both kind of a little similar and a little bit different from the traditional pulmonary artery catheter. When you do a thermodilution with a traditional pulmonary artery catheter, the you inject the cold saline and it goes into the right atria and then goes down to the pulmonary artery and it does the change in temperature curve, and that gives you your cardiac output.
Right.
And the difference with this one is that you will put it into a catheter that's with a tip like a central line, that's the tips at the right atria, and the cold saline goes across the heart into the lungs and into the left heart circulation and then down the aorta, and then you put in a femoral artery catheter, and the thermistor is down there. So it does the thermodilution catheter transiting both the heart and the lungs and the aorta. And that gives you some information about where the volume is getting diluted in between where you injected it and where it was measured that you can't get with a pulmonary artery catheter. And how that works is that you're calculating a cardiac output with the thermodilution,
Right.
and that thermodilution is derived off of the change in temperature curve. And so cardiac output is a flow, which is volume divided by time. And what it does is it measures the temperature change at given times so that if you multiply that back by the cardiac output, you get a volume.
Right.
So for instance, the largest so the what's called a mean transit time, or how long it takes half of the thermodilution to happen, will give you the volume of all the liquid in the chest, and so that gives you your interthoracic thermal volume, and is you can then take a different time, like your something called a downslope time, and that will tell you how much of the blood is actually in the largest chamber in the chest, which is the lung tissue and the lung blood volume.
Right.
So there's you subtract that from the all the blood in the chest, and that gives you the end-diastolic blood volume of the heart. So the blood in the lung is about 1.25 times the end-diastolic blood of the heart. You subtract that, and that gives you extravascular lung water. So when you're resuscitating someone with fluids, you can get an idea of how wet the lungs are.
Okay. And what sort of additional information, or how do you use this in your resus? So you're resuscitating someone, you're making, because it's all in the end about decision points, right? We only have so many things that we can intervene upon. We've got fluids, we've got pressors, we've got inotropes, and then the rest is pretty much like, slight tweaks on those choices of inotropes, or is there a procedure intervention needs to be done? So where in your decision tree does this sort of, send you one way or another?
Yeah, so there's a lot of advantages of this to traditionally I done a lot of just resus with the echo,
Sure.
and this actually can make it easier on you so that you don't have to keep dragging the echo back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. But I always kind of had this idea in my head that once you resuscitated somebody and you get the B-lines, you kind of already lost the game because the lungs are wet.
Right, that was kind of Daniel Lichtenstein's falls protocol, of a decade ago, which I think was made a lot of sense. at least to say that once you've got beelines appearing, well, it's definitely time to stop. But I think we're all in agreement that once they've appeared, you've already overshot the mark, and the idea is to catch it a bit sooner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's one thing, is that I noticed that, you know, it tells you how much volume is in the lungs. And so you can see that, you know, even though you're still before the beelines are going to show up, that where you're heading. And you also can see, like with a fluid challenge, if you think that the patient does need volume ahead of time, that, you know, say it goes from like 7 cc's per kilo to 10 cc's per kilo with a small bolus, you say, hey, I got to be very careful here. In addition, so what this thing does is it actually calibrates the femoral artery tracing and does pulse contour analysis to give you a cardiac output. So it's not an uncalibrated system. It actually calibrates your cardiac output so you can more reliably believe that and look at friends. You can also, you know, if you wanted to, you could do your straight leg test or whatever, and get that to see if, look, are they even volume responsive? You get a calculation of your, you know, systemic vascular resistance because you have a central line in for your right atrial pressures and that, and also the cardiac output. It gives you, since you're dealing with volumes, it does give you a measurement of how much volume is in the heart, and so you get a global sort of estimate of preloading condition.
Right.
So while a pulmonary artery catheter is going to give you
pressures,
this is going to give you volumes, which, you know, theoretically would be more information about the preload itself. And, you know, you can estimate pressures with the echo, too. And so you can kind of put that together into an idea about how compliant the ventricle is, and that, use that on top of, you know, like your diastology sort of Doppler studies, and cross-check that as well. And, of course, if you have a pretty stiff, non-compliant heart, again, you got to be careful with the fluids, even more so than you normally would be. It can actually give you a calculation based on the cardiac output and how much the volume is in the heart, and that gives you a cardiac function index and a global ejection fraction, which can clue you in if this is maybe a patient that will do well with an inotrope or not. Finally, it can take a ratio of how much extravascular lung water there is to the total blood volume, and that tells you what's called a pulmonary vascular permeability index, which is how leaky those blood vessels are.
Yeah.
So that gives you kind of a risk assessment of, okay, if I give them 250 of, you know, crystalloid here, how much is that likely going to wind up in the lungs?
Yeah, that's a really useful thing, because I think otherwise we're, you know, right now for volume tolerance on the pulmonary side, it's really, to me at least, it's FiO2 and it's my gross, you know, ultrasound exam. Like, obviously, is there fusions? Is there, you know, how extensive are the beelines? But at a certain point, it becomes hard to really, like, unless you're really, like, doing the full chest, you know, beeline exam in, like, 12 points or something like that, it's kind of hard to quantitate. Even then you might not be able to differentiate, you know, really, it couldn't get worse. You could probably still get, you know, quote unquote, the lung rockets, you know, 3 beelines per interspace, but it could still probably get worse than that and you can't really differentiate it. So it's a fairly coarse tool. But I imagine if you're seeing it, if you're seeing your permeability go up, or if you see that it's quite up, that gives you another sort of stop point or beware point, at least when you're looking at fluids.
Yeah. And, you know, like over the years, I think I've become more and more and more of a guy who is just volume restrictive in terms of my therapies. And sometimes I think I maybe go a little bit too far.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the patients I'm putting in when I'm like, gosh, you know, I really am thinking maybe a fluid bolus is going to help them. And their volume responsive. I did my straight leg test, and, you know, and they seem to be kind of clamped down, but they're you know, the right atrial pressures are a little low and their cardiac output's low, stroke volume's low. I kind of want to give this person some volume, but they're sick. I know they got leaky lungs because they got a raging pneumonia or whatever. I put one of these things in, and I can watch the volume wind up in the lungs and say, nope, it's happening too fast. I'm not going to do this. Or I feel encouraged that I actually can get away with it.
Right. Interesting. Interesting stuff. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to you showing us more of this at HNR next May. And we'll hopefully be able to run a little workshop on that too. So how, you know, because I get every now and then comments, you know, people saying, but, you know, he's not actually putting PA catheters, you know, or thermodilution catheters in the ER, is he? And yes, can you confirm that you are indeed doing that?
I'm not putting in the PA catheters in the emergency department. I'm putting these thermodilution catheters.
Right,
in here.
Right.
The transpulmonary thermodilution right. catheters. And yeah, I am putting those in. The PA catheter, I think, actually, kind of should, I guess, in the right patient, make a comeback. I you know, it kind of got ruined by, you know, the paper saying, well, you know, the doesn't change mortality rates or outcomes or all that. But I don't think that's true for a lot of things that we do. And just because it didn't change outcomes in a big population doesn't
right.
mean that it didn't give the clinician useful information, or if, you know, or if the clinician did the right thing with the information.
Exactly.
You know, I don't think that, you know, using a, you know, any of these, you know, invasive or semi-invasive sort of kind of high-end monitors make a difference if you don't know how to
absolutely
put everything together. Number one, number two, you're just dealing with one sort of set of data points, and you need to kind of look at the whole clinical picture and make a judgment. You know, because I will never use one of these, you know, transpulmonary thermal dilution catheters without incorporating my information with the echo.
And I
put it. It's an adjunct to my resuscitation with them using with my echo, my physical exam, the story, how they responded to the last intervention. You know, all that kind of stuff goes in together. And sometimes you get a little bit of conflicting information, and you always have to remember, you know, with a pulmonary artery catheter, you know, pressures aren't equaling preloads. It can be affected by compliance of the system and that sort of thing. And so you can't necessarily use it to predict, you know, if they're going to be volume responsive or not volume responsive. You kind of put that together, and if you can incorporate things like with your echo and your pressures that you're measuring and your touching the patient's skin and all this kind of stuff, you know, that's when you can use this information. And I think that, you know, to have as much information you can in the very sickest patients, I just think it has to make a difference.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. Now, you know, before a large RCT, you know, ever comes to show that is like, I think it's a decade or more away, because you'd have to have, in order to make it a large enough, you know, sample and couple centers for anyone to actually buy in, you'd have to have every treating doc along the way be able to do all these things. And that's, you know, we're nowhere near that yet. I mean, there's a lot of people who can, but for all those people to be involved, or enough people to be involved in a trial to make it, you know, statistically significant and generalizable to general ICU populations or general eMERGE shock populations is a monumentous task.
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll ever be done. I mean, I kind of wish it will, but in the end, I think we'll still do what we do based on physiology. And more importantly, I think it's the following up of things, you know, that you intervene on something and see that it has had some kind of positive physiological response. Like, we're bringing back the Swan-Ganz catheters in my unit, and we used to put them in the early 2000s, and they kind of got, you know, and I'm guilty of having put them aside for echo, but in the last, it's been a few years, I've been wanting to bring them back, but the nurses had all lost their competencies, so now we've got to, we're getting that rolling again, and it's not that easy, as I'm sure you know. I mean, you have this incredible nursing team in your eMERGE, but it's, you know, we're getting it rolling again, and because I think there is still lots of indications, and for me, for one, I would digressing a little bit from the transpulmonary dilution one, which I've never used, but for the PA catheters, I think one of the key things is, like, if you're going to be starting any kind of pulmonary vasodilators, you need to have a PA pressure monitor. I mean, you could, in theory, sit there and, you know, measure your PA pressure every 30 minutes with the echo, but that's highly impractical and less feasible. And you want to know that whatever you've intervened, you know, you've dropped your PA pressures. Otherwise, you know, if you've given inhaled milrinone or Flolan, but, you know, you've got no change, no effect, then, you know, these medications and anything we do has side effects, and we don't want to, you know, get just side effects and no benefits. So.
Right. Yeah. So I'm, you know, I have to, you know, say I actually do that with the echo. If I have a right heart failure patient, I actually do go with the echo and Doppler what's going on there and have a look and then you know, start the milrinone or the Flolan or whatever and then come back in about 20 minutes, 30 minutes and see where I'm at and then go from there. And yeah, it is a big pain in the neck. And so if you do have a pulmonary artery catheter, that would be the advantage over a transpulmonary thermal dilution catheter, is if you did have right-sided heart failure, you would want to use a pulmonary artery catheter over a transpulmonary thermal dilution catheter. It would save you a lot of time. You've got a busy shift or whatever, and it is kind of a pain in the neck to go back and do it, but I just think it's the right thing to do, you know. And, is if you got a patient sick enough to need a milrinone and a pulmonary vasodilator, they deserve you to at least go back, do that echo again and check things, make sure they're going the right way.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree. It's also what I do, but it's I'm going to say that to save face, but it would be nice to be able to just trend it and see and all.
Oh,
that.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And absolutely. But, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, but I mean, the optimal thing there is, like, you know, you put in the pulmonary artery catheter and you have the echo, and you use them to see.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the, you know, for all the right reasons that you said earlier on why the PA catheter disappeared, and I think many of those were wrong reasons, and I think it does have to be brought back in the right hands with the right, you know, interventions, and also paired with echo, because looking at just pressure values makes little sense to me, and I think that's one of the reasons why things went awry, you know. But you tie it in together, and I think that is the well, what resuscitation should be a multimodal, you know, integrated thing where you're looking at a lot of different things. And I do find the pulmonary, the transpulmonary dilution stuff interesting, because that permeability, we don't have currently a way to really look at it sort of real time. It's more like we see the effects and you're like, oh shoot, I shouldn't have done that. As opposed to being able to see it happen maybe early enough to be like, okay, hit the brakes, you know?
Yeah, that's what I really love about it. It's so helpful in those, like, really sick and tricky patients.
And basically, in a sense, like, you're just putting in a central line and an art line, so which you need anyways.
Yeah.
So you're not really actually doing anything additional than what you what you need to do. And in our eMERGE, actually, we've recently, as part of our sort of advanced, you know, resuscitation, advanced ACLS 3.0 steps, we've managed to get art lines put in eMERGE, and that was, you know, a hurdle in and of itself. And I'm really proud of our eMERGE team, you know, docs and nursing, to have gone along with this and have gotten the nurses trained and be able to do this, because we're actually, at least in Montreal, we're one of the few emergency rooms that will put art lines, which, as you know, I'm sure for cardiac arrest cases are really important things to do.
Oh yeah, when I have a cardiac arrest patient, I usually have a femoral art line in within I put it into the first pulse check.
Yeah.
You know, first rhythm, first pulse check, that thing, you know, that goes right in the femoral artery, drop a guideline, check back on the chest. Once you have the art line in, you pretty much are done with chest compression interruptions. You can get all kinds of information. And then, again, then you know, I have transesophageal echo too I can use, and the two of them together are just like game changers for cardiac arrest.
We'll save that chat for another time, but that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that in that angle before, but it's just a central line and art line. You need them anyways. You might as well get that additional information if you're going to, like, in a sense, it's kind of foolish to be putting a regular central line and a regular art line and you have no further information. You might as well get that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you need to put it in every shock patient, but the very sickest patients where you got to be careful with the fluids and make the right decisions and all that, you know, put one of those things in and incorporate it with the echo, your physical exam and kind of your gestalt of how the patient looks as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks very much for joining me today, Corbin. Always a pleasure and some good learning whenever I get to listen to you.
It's always great to talk to you.